You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
This is Kick-Ass Politics. I'm Ben Mathis. Hi, folks. Before we start the show, I want to ask for your help. If you enjoy Kick-Ass Politics, I hope you'll help us reach our goal of raising our full production budget for 2016 by donating on our website at kickasspolitics.com or at gofundme.com/kickasspolitics. Thanks for listening, and now enjoy the show. Hi, I'm Ben Mathis, and welcome to Kick-Ass Politics. Last week, I talked with theoretical physicist and futurist Dr. Michio Kaku about some of the amazing technology coming our way in just the next couple of decades. Well, today's episode sort of dovetails with that conversation, because we're going to talk about the innovations that will spur the next industrial revolution. With an eye on the next 10 to 20 years, what sectors will drive the U.S. economy? What industries should you be investing in now? Who will be hiring? And what skill sets will be most in demand? The guy who'll answer those questions is one of America's leading experts on innovation, Alec Ross. He served for 4 years as Senior Advisor for Innovation to Secretary of State Hillary Clinton. In that role, he acted as the diplomatic lead on a range of issues, including cybersecurity, internet freedom, disaster response, and the use of network technologies in conflict zones. Now he's a distinguished fellow at Johns Hopkins University and serves as an advisor to investors, corporations, and government leaders. He's been listed among Huffington Post's top 10 game changers in politics and the top 100 global thinkers by Foreign Policy magazine. He has a new best-selling book called Industries of the Future, in which he examines the specific fields that will most shape our economic future, including robotics, cybersecurity, commercialization of genomics, big data, and the coming impact of digital technology on money and markets. Today we'll talk about all of that, plus we'll discuss how Americans can adapt to the changing nature of work, the prospect of a cyber war arms race, and what today's parents can do to prepare their children for tomorrow. Coming up with my guest, Alec Ross, in just a moment.
To Washington, it's time for Kick-Ass Politics. And now here's your host, Ben Mathis.
Alec Ross, thanks for joining me on the podcast.
Great to be here.
Well, you have a new book called Industries of the Future, which has been doing extremely well, and it raises some interesting questions about the next big economic revolution. You grew up in West Virginia, coal country, and as a young man, you saw your classmates, you know, we're mostly kids of coal miners who didn't prepare and adapt to globalization and emerging industries in the last couple of decades. Is that part of why you decided to write this book, to prepare people?
That's exactly why I wrote this book. You know, I've been really lucky, you know, growing up a public school kid in West Virginia who's achieved, you know, a little bit of professional success in life. And, you know, I got to tell you, the kids who I went to school with back in West Virginia, I believe are made of exactly the same stuff as the people who are at the absolute heights of the business world and the political world. You know, I think that talent is universally distributed, but opportunity is not. So the reason why I wrote The Industries of the Future was for folks who are, you know, either getting out of college now or parents who are thinking about what skills their kids need to try to light a little path about what's going to happen in the world next economically, to give them a fair shot.
Yeah, and you cover five industries, but you start off with robotics. Now, there are a lot of people out there who say robotics is going to be different than previous industrial revolutions in that it's probably going to take away more jobs than it's going to create. Are they right?
You know, unfortunately, I think they are. You know, I'm a mostly optimistic person, and I have a mostly optimistic view of the future. Most people who write books about the future are either utopian. Oh, we're going to live to be 150 years old, happy, wealthy, wise, wanting for nothing, or dystopian, you know, written from sort of the fetal position with fists clenched. I think life is a little bit more up the middle, neither utopian nor dystopian. But on this topic of robotics, I do think that it is going to take away more labor than it creates. I think the robots of the cartoons and movies from the 1970s are going to be the reality of the 2020s.
And certain things that you bring up here would lead me to think that we may be lagging behind on this, because you talk about countries like Japan and South Korea may be ahead of us because we've had cheap, easily available immigrant labor. So we haven't had to make big advances in robotics yet. And also you talk about psychologically, the West is far more skeptical of robotics and far more uncomfortable with it than, say, Japan.
No, you're absolutely right. It's fascinating. You know, in Western societies like ours, we are taught to fear that which we animate, which perhaps we ought not. So from Icarus and his waxed wings to Prometheus bringing fire to humans, to Frankenstein, you know, we're told, you know, be really careful about, you know, trying to make things human or bring things to humans that we shouldn't. But by contrast, Eastern societies don't have that cultural baggage. And what's more is where those of us who are Christian and Western view robots and robotics as soulless. And, you know, look, I view that myself. I view them as inanimate pieces of machinery with code inside. In Japan, for example, 80% of Japanese people practice a religion called Shinto,
right,
which believes in animism, which believes that all objects have souls. And so they have less compunction about creating robots that do things like take care of elderly grandparents than, say, we would in the United States. Now, the United States still does great work in robotics. You know, of the 196 countries on planet Earth, you know, the five that matter most are the United States, Germany, Japan, South Korea, and China. But I do see South Korea and Japan in particular really racing out there ahead of us because they have a cultural disposition to robotics and they don't have the low-cost immigrant labor to do things that, you know, they have to build robots to do in South Korea and Japan.
Yeah, and going back to the other question earlier, how do we adapt if there are going to be fewer jobs? Is it just a question of we want to be at the top of that job pyramid and, you know, whatever country's at the bottom, it's just too bad for them?
So I think that we have to approach this in two ways. First of all, we have to make sure that if we are moving into a world with more artificial intelligence and more robotics, let's make sure the headquarters for those big old robotics companies and artificial intelligence companies, let's make sure they're American so that, you know, the headquarters are here, the taxes they pay are American taxes, the engineers that are hired, you know, the well-being, let's make it American. So that's thing one. Now, that helps a lot, but it doesn't necessarily help the kind of folks who I grew up with. You know, I worked as a midnight janitor when I was in college to help put myself through college. And the kinds of guys who I work shoulder to shoulder with on the janitorial crew, you know, it doesn't necessarily help them that much if the headquarters of the big robotics company is in the U.S. So the second thing I think we need to do is we need to take a good hard look at segments of our education system like vocational ed and community colleges, which maybe not, maybe people don't talk a lot about at the cool kids table, but you know what? Vocational education and community college serve millions and millions and millions of people. And what we've got to make sure is that the kind of education being delivered for those very vulnerable Americans puts them in positions where they can tell the machines what to do instead of the machines telling them what to do. Because those are the segments of America where, you know what, they're not going to become the highest end engineers and they're not going to become entrepreneurs. So let's make sure we aren't just cast them off to the side of the road, you know?
Yeah, and that's an interesting point because you do talk about the need to re-educate people and give them new skill sets. And to me, it seems like that would be a huge leap because in many cases, you're talking about taking people from low-skilled service worker jobs to high-tech jobs of the future. Realistically, we're not going to take someone who has a GED, you know, all the way to a PhD in robotics. So
we're not,
how do we bridge that chasm?
So the way we do it, first of all, is we have to focus on young people. You know, we've got to focus on people as the economy grows more global. Being mediocre at your job, where the best attribute you have for that job is a set of strong shoulders. Mm-hmm. You know, look, you are going to be decreasingly competitive in a global economy. And so what we have to do is make sure that the educations that people are getting are mapped to areas of high growth. Now, that could be as a plumber or as an electrician. You know, these are going to forever be in demand. A good plumber will always be well compensated and needed. But what we can't do is continue to try. We can't prepare people for an industrial and manufacturing-based job that just doesn't exist anymore. And so what I'd love to see us focus on is trying to get the manufacturing for things like robotics in the United States and training people here in the U.S. so that they can add real value and help us create an advanced manufacturing sector here like we see happening through much of the U.S. right now, including in the Rust Belt.
Yeah, and another one of the big industries that you talk about, which I covered last week in some detail with Michio Kaku, is life sciences and genomics. You say that the drug development process is not keeping pace with genomics advances and the need for these personalized treatments that we're going to have. Are we going to hit a wall at some point where we have the information, but we don't have the drugs to fix the problems?
So the short answer to that is yes. So the world's last trillion-dollar industry was created out of computer code. The world's next trillion-dollar industry is going to be created out of genetic code. You know, we're now about 15 years past the mapping of the human genome. So we are going, and we're finally at the point where we have the computing power and the data sets to be able to do the kind of early diagnostics and precision medicine development that has been hoped for a long time. But here's the open question. The open question is the way that we bring drugs to market, which is incredibly expensive and very heavily regulated in Washington, are we going to take friction? Are we going to take a little bit of regulation out of that so that it can be easier to develop precision medicines? And if we don't, my prediction is that the Chinese will do it. You know, the world's largest sequencer of genetics right now is not American. It's BGI, the Beijing Genomics Institute. And so in the same way in which many respects, I think that the United States won the internet. I mean, we became the home of e-commerce and social media and search engines. We did the innovation and the commercialization here. It's an open question whether we're the ones who are able to do the commercialization and reap the benefit of that $1 trillion worth of wealth that I think is going to be created. And the biggest barrier to doing that, in my opinion, is regulatory. Is the heavy hand of Washington going to make it too hard to do entrepreneurship in the life sciences in America?
Yeah, we need to hopefully get the FDA to loosen up regulations and maybe allow for a little more wiggle room with clinical trials and so forth.
Yes. You know, I'm not a laissez-faire guy. I don't think that business should be able to do whatever it wants without any oversight at all. But what I do believe is that government should be in the business, at least in for the most part, in enabling entrepreneurship, you know, making life for business people, for inventors, for innovators easier as opposed to harder. Yeah. And so what I want to make sure is that the people in the white coats who are doing the, you know, drug creation are not held back by the guys wearing the white shirts and the red ties in Washington. Because we want to win the commercialization of genomics in the same way in which we won the creation of wealth around the internet.
Yeah. The third industry that you talk about is the coming codification of money, markets, and trust. One of the things you talk about in here is the sharing economy or the gig economy. And your former boss, Hillary Clinton, in a lot of her stump speeches, uses the term gig economy kind of in a pejorative way, saying that these aren't jobs with healthcare plans and employee benefits and pensions. Does she need to perhaps change her thinking on this a little?
Well, you know, I don't know if it's pejorative or not. Here's what I'll say about it. And I don't think she means it pejoratively. Here is what I think her point is, but what I know what my point is, which is in a world where where more and more labor is going from being employer-based to project-based, in a world without pensions, without employer-based health insurance, without workers' comp if you get hurt on the job, if something like that happened during the industrial age or in a traditional employment setting, the responsibility falls to the employer. In the gig economy, it falls to the taxpayer and to government. And so in the same way in which we created a social compact during the industrial age, where we had the 40-hour work week and employer-based health insurance and free public education, you know, there was sort of an exchange of value between the employer, the employee, and government. We're still sort of finding our way in the information-based economy. And I am all for the gig economy. I don't call it the sharing economy because nobody's sharing anything. Try to be a part of the sharing economy without your credit card. Yeah. but, you know, I'm all in favor of it. I love the innovation. I love being able to take a latent good like, you know, an empty apartment and monetize it. That's fantastic. But my question is, you know, all right, well, those protections that historically would have been employer-based, how, you know, what do we do? And I'm not saying what we should do, but I'm saying we need to figure it out because otherwise it's just all going to fall on the taxpayer. You know, somebody gets hurt on the job and is suddenly can't work for 6 months. Well, they're getting unemployment insurance and they're on Medicaid, you know, so we got to think about what the social contract is.
Well, it seems that millennials don't care so much about these traditional job benefits. If they're able to be their own boss and have more free time and flexible schedules, I think that a lot of millennials are okay with not having employer health care or job security. My sense is that for most of them, that's an acceptable trade-off that they're willing to make.
Yeah, so if you're a millennial, these are far-off concerns. Yeah. So this is one of the things where we aren't really going to have to... This will be most pressing in 10, 15, 20 years when people who got their start in the sharing economy suddenly have kids, when people do start getting hurt on the job, when they do suddenly suffer for not having pensions. So, you know, if you're a millennial or if you're a new immigrant who's just happy to be in America and, you know, getting some money in your wallet, it's great. But as the basis for 30 years of employment, it's trickier. Mm-hmm. Now, I do think some frameworks will be created. Like, look, I think that there's $1 billion to be made out there by somebody who comes up with the, you know, insurance scheme for the sharing economy. So my whole thing is let's not bash the sharing economy or the gig economy. Let's be really creative. Think about what the gaps are and then, you know, take a market-based approach to filling the gaps. So if we don't have workers' comp insurance, health insurance, or pensions if you're a part of the gig economy, well, let's figure out mechanisms for doing it. Let's create, you know, employee-based 401ks or things like this.
Right. And who's to say that the sharing economy itself may not come up with better alternatives to employer health insurance and pension plans, et cetera? Well, we're going to take a quick break, and then I'll be back to talk more with Alec Ross, author of Industries of the Future. Back in just a moment. If you're interested in my conversation with Alec Ross, then you'll enjoy his new book, Industries of the Future. And right now, you can download the audio version of that book for free with a special promotion for our listeners from audible.com. Just go to audibletrial.com/kickasspolitics for a free 30-day trial and a free audiobook download, which can be Industries of the Future by my guest today, Alec Ross, or any of Audible's 180,000 titles. That's audibletrial.com/kickasspolitics. Or click on the sponsor link on our webpage to download the free audiobook of your choice. And now, back to the show. We're back, and today I'm talking with Alec Ross, author of Industries of the Future. So, Alec, one thing that you talk about as being a big driver of both the sharing economy and globalization is something called blockchain. Now, I know very little about Bitcoin, and as I understand it, it's never really taken off. But you talk about this technology called blockchain that came out of Bitcoin as something that's going to be a very, very big game changer. So what exactly is blockchain?
Yeah, so blockchain, so let me back up and say, so blockchain was something that was developed for Bitcoin, Bitcoin being this, what was a hoped for digital currency. You know, as you said, it didn't really take off. It's more of a speculative asset. You know, something that whose value goes way up and way down, as opposed to a currency, which has a store of value and is a medium of exchange. I think of Bitcoin like one of those search engines from the 1990s, you know, like Lycos, InfoSeek, WebCrawler. You know, I do think that there can be a digital currency that emerges without some of Bitcoin's flaws. But one thing that did emerge out of the creation of Bitcoin is this blockchain technology that you describe. And I think that that is something that's going to be enduring. And what the blockchain basically is it's a technology that enables people to do very highly trusted transactions on the internet. And so in the same way in which HTML became a way that we could visualize the internet, bring the World Wide Web to life, so too do I think that this distributed ledger system that allows for people to transfer assets very easily and without friction can be a platform for doing high-value transactions on the internet. So just by way of example, right now, if you try to transfer money from one country to another, it is a total headache, and it costs a ton of money. Yeah. So all these folks from Mexico who are transferring money back home, you know, they're losing 8-10% of what they've earned in transfer fees. Instead of 8-10%, that should be, you know, 0.1%.
You know, another one that you talk about here that's kind of fits right into that is cybersecurity. You say if any college student asks you what career would most assure 50 years of steady employment, you say cybersecurity. What is attractive about cybersecurity? Why is that going to be perhaps the biggest of these industries of the future?
Yeah, so Ben, right now as you and I are on the phone, 2016, we live in a world of 16 billion internet-connected devices. That's the sum of our smartphones, our iPads, our internet-connected laptops, the sensors that are in supply chains. When we talk in 4 years, which is not that long from now, 2020, that number will have gone from 16 billion to 40 billion. And so what that means is that we are networking things that, you know, previously weren't internet connected, like our cars, like our household appliances, like our supply chains. And as we go from a world where everything is connected, the security threats rise along with it. So in the same way in which we have to worry about people hacking our laptop today, tomorrow we're going to have to worry about people hacking our car. And so, you know, I think that the weaponization of code is the most significant development in conflict since the weaponization of fissile material. The difference being creating a nuclear weapon requires access to the scarcest of scarce scientific talent and transuranium elements, whereas creating a cyber weapon is a lot easier.
Are we going to need some kind of a Geneva Convention for cyber war?
Yes. So right now, there are no rules. It's sort of the Wild West in cyber conflict. And in the same way in which, beginning in the 1950s and running through the 1980s, we created nuclear treaties to slow down nuclear proliferation and to keep us from annihilating the human race, so too do we need a set of treaties and a set of rules to which people can be held account and for which countries can be held to account in cyber conflict. Because unlike nuclear war, where it was just, you know, half a dozen or so countries who got access to these weapons, in weaponized cyberspace, we're talking about a dozen or more countries that can develop very powerful cyber weapons.
If we did something like that, how do we know that rogue nations and countries like North Korea and Iran would abide by that?
Well, if we don't, we punish them. You know, it's the same way that we did to various degrees with nuclear weapons. When the Syrians developed nuclear capabilities, the Israelis bombed the facilities. You know, the part of what you do with Geneva Accords is you arrive at consensus, and when people act outside of that consensus, they pay the consequences for it.
Well, I want to talk about the final industry of the future that you talk about here. You talk about big data. And you have some experience with that because you worked in the data operation of the Obama campaign. Now, this is interesting to me because earlier in the book, you talk about data analysis being one of the dying jobs, one of the jobs that will be very quickly replaced by robotics. But then in the end, you talk about it as an industry of the future. So is this a job of the past or is this a job of the future then?
I think that land was the raw material of the agricultural age, iron was the raw material of the industrial age, and data is the raw material of the information age. So I think that the kind of data analytics that are being developed today are going to be a very big and very important part of our future. And what's going to be interesting about it is it's not going to be so much a standalone industry unto itself, as these data analytics are going to infuse through other industries. So like agriculture, you know, agriculture integrating big data analytics, I think can help us grow more food, better food, and healthier food. You know, so I actually think that big data analytics are going to have are going to help us transform a lot of, you know, quote unquote, traditional industries.
Yeah. Who are going to be the winners and losers in the industries of the future?
Well, I think that the winners on a country by country basis, I think that the winners are going to be those countries that are most open. And what I mean by open is they allow upward economic and social mobility for people from all social classes. They create environments that lend themselves to creativity, commercialization, and entrepreneurship. The ones that I think are going to be the big losers are going to be the more closed societies, where things are dictated from on high, where cultural norms are set from central authorities. You know, if you look at the places that are the most creative and that are creating the industries of the present, they tend to be places that are wildly open. And I think that that's going to be true in the future. Going to individuals, I think that those who are most adaptable to change and most willing to change are going to be those that are positioned to compete and succeed. You know, it's not going to be the case that when you graduate from college, you get a job and you stay with that employer for 30 years. You know, we've got to be increasingly adaptable, mobile, and lifelong learners. So on an individual basis, that's who I think is going to do well.
Yeah, and it's interesting because many of the issues you grapple with in the book mirror what I would euphemistically call the conversations going on in this election. The resistance to globalization and free trade and immigrants replacing jobs here. Are there some people who are just going to be victims of their own stubbornness?
Yes. Perhaps? Look, I think that, and this is a case where I fault the far left and the far right. You know, I think that, you know, where I grew up in West Virginia, working class West Virginia, there's a lot of anxiety. And I see people going to socialism in one political extreme and fascism in another political extreme. Because in my opinion, both socialists and fascists are giving people, are pointing fingers at who's to blame for globalization and economic stagnation. And I find that to be incredibly unproductive. Yeah. You know, for me, I say, look, the world is growing more global, whether we like it or not. You know, we're not going to be able to become a neo-mercantilist country. The question for me is, how do we make sure that the United States becomes the headquarters for all the industries of the future? How do we make sure that these great jobs that are going to be created, because we've got some incredibly smart, well-educated, imaginative people here, how do we get the jobs, how do we get the companies headquartered here, the jobs created here, and the people educated to staff them here? So that's where I'm really focused in all this.
Well, before we go, I just want to ask you real quickly about the last chapter in the book. It's called The Most Important Job You'll Ever Have. And you say you asked everyone you interviewed for the book, what are the attributes today's kids will need for the industries of the future? What were some of the most common answers?
You know, one thing that surprised me, but it totally makes sense now that I think about it, is interdisciplinary learning. So every, you know, there's a lot of focus on STEM education, science, technology, engineering, and mathematics, mm-hmm. and that's justifiable. But I became increasingly convinced as I interviewed people that the people who are going to be the real leaders in the industries of the future are going to be people who are comfortable with things that are technical, scientific or technological, but they combine that with some of the skills from the humanities, like great communication skills or behavioral psychology. You know, I point to Mark Zuckerberg and Facebook as an example. Everybody thinks of Facebook as a product of a, you know, computer scientist from Harvard, Mark Zuckerberg, and that's true. But what I believe is that Facebook became as big as it is as much because of Mark Zuckerberg's understanding of behavioral psychology as much as because he was a good computer science coder. And so I think that one of the key attributes for tomorrow is interdisciplinary learning.
Interesting. Well, people better catch up or get left behind. The book is called The Industries of the Future by Alec Ross. Alec, thanks so much for joining me.
Thanks for having me, Ben.
Thanks again to Alec Ross for coming on the show. And if you enjoyed today's episode, I'd encourage you to read his new book, Industries of the Future. I'll include an Amazon link where you can order it in the show notes for this episode and on our website at kickasspolitics.com. Or if you'd prefer to listen to the audio version, you can download that for free through that special trial offer just for our listeners at audibletrial.com/kickasspolitics. You can follow Alec Ross on his website at alecross.com or on Twitter at Alec J. Ross. Be sure to subscribe to Kickass Politics on iTunes and leave us a review while you're there. And if you really want to help us out, then donate to our GoFundMe campaign at gofundme.com/kickasspolitics or click on the donate button on our website at kickasspolitics.com. Follow us on Twitter at KAPolitics or visit Kickass Politics on Facebook and recommend Kickass Politics to your friends on all of your social media. As always, I welcome your comments, questions, and suggestions at comments@kickasspolitics.com. In the next episode, I'll talk with Jacob Weisberg, chairman and editor-in-chief of Slate.com. Like many in the media, he has a perverse obsession with Donald Trump, and he's indulging that obsession with his new semi-daily podcast called TrumpCast. Jacob and I will talk about all things Donald Trump, from how the whole Trump phenomenon happened in the first place, to the prospect of a contested convention, and his chances in the general election. We'll cover his oft-bragged-about deal-making skills and compare that with his real track record as a businessman. We'll also talk about what it's like to be part of Donald Trump's traveling press corps. Plus, Jacob will reveal what he's learned about what women, minorities, Muslims, and even psychologists have to say about the Donald. Coming up with Jacob Weisberg, editor of Slate.com, on the next podcast. But for now, I'm Ben Mathis, and thanks for listening to Kick-Ass Politics.